This is Catherine Hastings. Tonight's program is a special tribute to the poet and writer David Bromidge, who died in his Sebastopol home on June 3rd of this year at the age of 75. When speaking of Bromidge, who had a rich history and left behind a large body of work that varies greatly from book to book, it is difficult to know where to begin. I've decided to start tonight's program by reading portions of his biography that appears on Wikipedia, a bio I know he approved of. Later in the show, I'll play various recordings of Bromidge and introduce his wife, Cecilia, daughter Margaret, and others. Before moving on, though, I'm going to play Otis Spann singing Trouble in Mind. Cecilia tells me that David used to play piano while Margaret sang this song.
Trouble in mind, I'm a blue, but I won't be blue away, 'cause the sun gonna shine in my back door someday. I'm gonna lay my head on some lonesome railroad. I'm letting 219 ease my trouble in mind.
David Mansfield Bromidge, born October 22, 1933, died June 3, 2009, was a Canadian poet who resided in Northern California from 1962 onward. Bromidge published 30 books, each one so different from the others as to seem to be the work of a different author. Bromidge is often associated with the language poets, but this connection is based mainly on his close friendships with some of those poets. It is difficult to fit Bromidge into a slot. He departs from language poetry in the thematic unity of many of his poems, in the uses to which he puts found materials, with a romantic aspect of his lyricism, and with a sheer variety of his approaches to the poem. Bromage was born in London, England. At an early age, he showed signs of being tubercular and was sent to an isolation hospital. But after 4 months, his condition improved and he was discharged. That hospital was the first of 4 crucial interludes which molded his adult life. The second of these interludes came during the London Blitz. A stick of bombs falling in their customary sequence appeared likely to destroy the Bromage's house with them inside. The next interlude involves his schooling and work experience. When the war ended, Bromage won a scholarship to Haberdashers Askey's Hampstead School and a chance to study at a socially superior school. After completing his school certificate, Bromage accepted an offer to be a dairyman on a farm in southern Sweden. Each of these interludes changed him. The first made him suspicious of his family. The bombing made him vow to be someone else. Work and study gave him the worldly experience to be a poet. Bromage attended the University of British Columbia, where he was encouraged to write and publish his work. At the 1963 Vancouver Poetry Festival, he met Robert Creeley, Charles Olson, Denise Levertov, Allen Ginsberg, and Robert Duncan. The result of this endeavor led to the publication of many poems. Robert Hass, the chairman of the Western States Book Award Committee, wrote glowingly of his work and chose his 1988 book, Desire, Selected Poems 1963 to 1987, to win the first prize for poetry. He was twice honored by the Poetry Foundation, and he was twice honored by the National Endowment for the Arts. He won the college prize for the first poem he ever published. 3 years later, Bromage won a Woodrow Wilson scholarship. The rule stated that he had to do his graduate work at a different university. In 1962, he chose the University of California at Berkeley after graduating from the University of British Columbia. Leaving UC Berkeley, Bromage took a teaching position in the English department at Sonoma State University in 1970. Then came 7 books in 2 years. This was Bromage at an early peak. 10 years in the making began it. This book consisted of some of his early work going back to 1960. Then selections from The Gathering, followed by poems from Threads. Next came Birds of the West from Victor Coleman of Coach House Press in Toronto. This book consists of 3 sections, a journal of gardening and visitors, a section of more finished poems filled with the landscape of western Sonoma County, and a single long poem written in sparse triplets to reflect a white-tail kite's hovering flight. Soon afterwards, Tight Corners and What's Around Them was issued by Black Sparrow. Bromage stated it was the most interesting to him of his clutch of books. Quote, I was using a fairly familiar sort of sentence in prose with a last line that either boasted sales or fell flat as a flapjack. I didn't care. Banal or brilliant, it made no difference in the world I was living in. Besides, sometimes the banal turned brilliant as I listened. Bromage continued to publish prodigiously in magazines and in 1980 published a book called My Poetry, a book I'll bring up again later in this show. Bromage retired early from Sonoma State University in 1993 and continued to publish and give readings. Tiny Courts in a World Without Scales, Brick Books, is a book of 50 short poems showing Bromage at his drawl and sarcastic best. He had fun with They Ate, a cup up from a turn-of-the-century detective novel, before producing A Cast of Tens, Avec Press. Each stanza has 10 lines, but in each poem is distributed variously. The Harbor Master of Hong Kong, Sun and Moon Publications, came next with many kinds of writing, including a perfect sonnet. Bromage's final book from the 90s was Vulnerable Bundles, a limited edition of 30, from Poets and Poets Press. Missing teaching, Bromage returned to it part-time at the University of San Francisco, and he also began writing what would later be As in Tea, As in Tether, which was awarded a Best Book of the Year in 2003, recognition from Small Press Traffic. To see a complete bibliography of Bromage's work, you can go to wikipedia.org. I also encourage you to visit bromage.wordpress.com, where you can view pictures, posts from his family and friends, and more. Bromage's rich and varied history is reflected beautifully at this site. I mentioned his book, My Poetry, a moment ago. Bromage won a Pushcart Prize for this book. The title poem consists of quotations from reviews about his work. I think this, as much as anything else he has written, shines a light on the man's immense wit and sense of humor. The poem begins, "My poetry does seem to have a cumulative, haunting effect. One or two poems may not touch you, but a small bookful begins to etch a response. Poems rising in blisters that itch for weeks. Poems like ball bearings turning on each other over and over, digging down far enough to find substance, a hard core to fill up the hand. It's through this small square that my poems project themselves, flicking across the consciousness, finally polarizing in the pure plasma of life. The readers grow impatient, irritated with my distancing style, coming at him in the rare book format, written under not one but two different kinds of dirty money, and knowing me to be an English teacher." Next, I'll play a collage of recordings by David Bromage and others. David Bromage reading from The Harbor Master of Hong Kong, recorded by Jack Foley in January 1994.
This is the first poem in the book. "Altogether too useful, a resource at a distance, to admit to actual presence. This is what once we called being, big B, fat from meaning, the beginning of a sentence. But something happening in it, people come and go, clearly ensconced, in a handy remove. It's generative. How more so were one to risk it now and then? Ruminative. Remunerative. And so the far-flung colony signals back to capital. On the beach, a whale." There is no harbor master of Hong Kong. But I didn't know that when I started writing this book. But then when I started writing this book, it didn't have a title, or not that title. Years ago when I was in college, and I tell this anecdote in the title poem of this book, I knew a man who'd get drunk once a month and make long-distance phone calls, and it was less usual, I'm speaking about 30 years ago and more, for people to be doing, ordinary citizens to be making long-distance phone calls. And one of them was to the harbor master of Hong Kong. Now, I wasn't there for this one. This was hearsay. And I was told that when he finally got through, all he had to say was, "Clear those junks out of there, we're coming through." This was considered very amusing in 1957. So, it's probably racist, but it certainly anyway is very ethnocentric and colonial and imperious, and as well as imperial. So I wrote this poem called The Harbor Master of Hong Kong because I was reading a work by Jürgen Habermas, the German sociologist.
A word that is close to Habermas.
Yeah, and I was following the ear in that.
Yes.
And it reminded me of The Harbor Master of Hong Kong, and I was very interested in following events in Hong Kong, which I see as a kind of epitome, if you can find an epitome anywhere these days, of the world situation. It's a center through which much money passes very fast, and its current teetering stability is threatened with total destabilization, as we all are. But in Hong Kong's case, this is known. It's known to be 5 years off, and it's only now 3 years off. So that seemed useful. And then I was visiting some friends in Toronto, and I met a woman who grew up in Hong Kong. And she asked me what the title of my next book was. I said, Harbor Master of Hong Kong. She laughed. I asked her why, she was so merry about this. I was pleased. And she said, because there is no Harbor Master of Hong Kong. And I was delighted, appalled and delighted by this news. Now, I haven't checked up on it.
Sonnet, From Tight Corners and What's Around Them.
If your child is holding you in an intensity of feeling that you find too difficult to bear, you can abstract yourself by naming this experience biological identity. There is a use of category that brings hopeless reassurance. You think of Big B being with all that term can bear to you. You needn't think it rhymes with Big B Boeing in that rare realm where you are Big G going. And call the boy your son. This is a sonnet.
Here is Jack Foley reading a poem by David Bromage that he wrote about his friend Robert Duncan.
Often to a cafe. He was plenty of years older than me. 15. For some reason, he liked me. And I don't know if he wanted to make a poet out of me. I wouldn't have minded. He encouraged me. To do what? To open up. I can't say that I ever satisfied him. He was insatiable. Sometimes I felt I had really disappointed, in the sense I had failed him. At other times, I felt I had satisfied him. It's a lot like sex, although I don't mean it to be. I wouldn't have liked to make love to Robert Duncan. It didn't go further for me. Had I been him after me, I couldn't have kept it going for long. We were friends. I couldn't smoke in his home, something I did with a great deal of vigor. So we'd go for a walk, often to a cafe. There was a German deli kind of place, and we'd drink coffee and have a sandwich, if it was time for us to have a sandwich. I loved him. I'll write more. Later.
I've just discovered a recording of David Bromage reading my poetry online, so I'm going to play that now. This was recorded in 1980. Apparently, there are about 10 seconds missing from this recording. I'll edit those 10 seconds down to just a few. Here now is David Bromage.
My poetry does seem to have a cumulated, haunting effect. One or two poems may not touch you, but a small bookful begins to etch a response. Poems rising in blisters that itch for weeks. Poems like ball bearings turning on each other over and over, digging down far enough to find substance, a hard core to fill up the hand. It's through this small square that my poems project themselves, flickering across the consciousness, finally polarizing in the pure plasma of life. The reader grows impatient, irritated with my distancing style, coming at him in a rare book format written under not one, but two different kinds of dirty money. And knowing me to be an English teacher. The Protestant poem and the prose piece He Was typify my tendency to write over-elaborated series of possibilities which become arid and abstract. It's possible for even the best current poetry to sink into oblivion without wholly justifying itself through such an absolute renunciation of mediocre success. My poetry is curiouser and curiouser as it makes a descent into the rabbit hole where descent becomes the subject of the poem's concern. Therefore, my style seems to have fallen apart, deteriorated in the 3-year interim between books. Some kind of decadence has set in. It's therefore become problematical, not to say impossible, because if it limits itself to the traditional language and form of a literature, it misses the basic truths about itself. While if it attempts to tell those truths, it abolishes itself as literature. At this point, then, we begin to glimpse what is the profound vocation of the work of art in a commodity society. Not to be a commodity, not to be consumed, to be unpleasurable in the commodity sense. If you allow Cézanne to represent a third dimension on his canvas, you must allow Landseer his gleam of loyalty in the spaniel's eye. I really don't think I'm demanding too much. The idea that poor... From aloud, and the mood in the car turned on a dime. For my poetry is informed by something inside that doesn't flinch and won't budge. Because a cold rage seizes one at times. Because a cold rage seizes one at whiles to show the bitter old and wrinkled truth stripped naked of all vesture that beguiles. Because it gives some sense of power and passion in helpless impotence to try to fashion our woe in living words. How e'er uncouth. I like the way these poems scan. They are type, rhythmical, colloquial, oblique lyrics. I find it exciting the way the terse English accent breaks through at times, asserting facts. The horned moon to shine by night amongst her spangled sisters bright. For his mercies I endure, ever faithful, ever sure. This is just to say, I've gained the art and language in which I bring my readers deeper than any consideration of a personality to the awareness of a living man. Hence, in reading these recent books of mine, one may find oneself in a solitude and a tight corner, I might call it, edge or risk of being that seems, even as it is most mine, to be speaking for a depth of one's own inner being. Climb being sort of is substitute destiny. Silence amounts to the same thing. Recommended for university and large college libraries. Sign on librarian's desk? Revenge. I could never have done it alone. Even a lower limit speech and an upper limit song leads instanta to a song. You make me dizzy, Miss Lizzie. Put your little hand in mine. And to a speech where soon enough we get tangled, spittle, called, simple, spread, friends, pleasure, forgive, sure, and rich or poor. One does not inherit an audience. One builds one, a reader at a time. I join these words for four people. Some others may overhear them. This air of seeming indifference toward the reader often succeeds. Join now.
Here is more of David Bromidge recorded in October of 1997. There are two places in this recording where, unfortunately, I will have to trim out a little language.
I've been writing a series called Vulnerable Bundles of poems in lines. But this one, this is number 92. I know I can't write this poem. Too disturbed. If you think sane, the behavior is very bizarre. If you think insane, this person is maintaining. I can't evoke many colored lotuses and elephant men when I'm being worried like a rat by a whippet. I don't like any of this stuff getting into the work. It comes in, I let it enter, but I don't have to like it that it does or I do. To me, the poem is refuge from the personal life. This day is like the floodplain between here and the next bigger, thoroughly ruinous town, littered with puddles and rural blight, the Chevys on cinder blocks, the tire piles, dirty gray light, yellow in it, the houses with bits falling off them and the people to a disordered mind likewise. The era is like that. The whole future could be that way. It's that kind of a day. On the refrigerator since pinned a news item concerning the burying of Carrie Derryberry. Her husband's name was Jerry. What sort of people could they have been, one wonders, growing up, him leastwise, with names that insistently try to eradicate disagreement? I've had it with disagreement. Jesus, it's a relief not to be writing a poem. It's a high, but it knocks the stuffing out of you. That woman who put her hand on my back at the soup cafe in Prince George, she liked me, and me likewise her. But that's easy to remember unspoiled since we exchange no further words or gestures. What is a paragraph? Like a shy model in the life class, most occasions tremble at the glimpse they have of themselves as inadequate. Standing there naked with naked feet and pubic hair and nipples lifting and all, and shoulder knobs and clavicles and ribcage and knees, magnificent. I severely dislike this prose. Why go on or do anything? It's time for Letterman. I watch and pretend he's Bob Grenier hosting a late-night talk show that uses only poets and that his first guest is going to be Lynn Hagenian. On comes Lynn, short, tight skirt, tan cleavage, and shoes to die for, says the sitter. Bob hugs her, kisses her hand. She had smile. The band leader is Paul de Barris. Most engaging on camera, intense and handsome, those dark blue eyes, big Portuguese smile, forearms like bowling pins. Barry Gifford's next. He and Bob joke about having the same initials, pretending to lower the level to Letterman. Larry Eigner wheels into camera range, and he and Bob joke about having anagrams for names. For 8 years on the same mailbox, says Bob. Then it's my turn. I recall the twilight when I drove up and parked and got out and saw what I thought was likely Larry working out on the porch rail. How, as I got close to him, I said, Larry, I thought that was you, and how he responded, oh, yeah, so did I. Pan to audience. They love it. Then again, they all look like me, Terence Dactyl, or my doppelganger, Professor Quincy Quatrain. I recline, pray for sleep, and nonetheless, eventually sleep comes. In my sleep, I'm indefatigable. I dream nonstop for 6 hours. Then I wake up and it's prose. Bowls of it for breakfast. Prose sandwich with peanut butter for lunch, eaten in the car en route to some errand I can't recall, so it certainly will be of no interest to the future. But on the way home, I scribble something that looks like, I was only lying for your convenience. You flushed my tongue down the toilet. The first time I saw you, I thought, one of us is at a loss for words. Bumper sticker. Visualize using your turn signals. I've always been something of a social activist. That's why I write in pedestrian prose. Few people know that accessible is my middle name. Now you are one of those few. It might be on the test. Spell it? Can't even pronounce it. It's in the Platonic dictionary. One free with any 5 zines of your choice. I used to do this from door to door. Then one day one of them opened. It was the door to poetry, and this side of me went to sleep.
And here is David Bromage reading Our Tongues. This was recorded in 1978.
Our Tongues. Skeletal muscle covered with mucous membrane compose our tongues. Expect to be nervous in the beginning. The frenulum is a fold of mucous membrane in the midline of the undersurface that helps to anchor our tongues to the floor of the mouth. Is the voice you hear soft, feminine, musical? Those women learned to sound like that. Because of this, the word decoded needs some explanation. Its visible surface is rippled by light scalloping across a row of strange little holes along one end. This may be credited to the whim of the builders. If the frenum is too short for freedom, the unmitigated lord of the creation is tongue-tied. Close your eyes, lie back, stick your tongue straight out as far as you can. Slide it back in as far as it will go. Dig those crazy sensations. Several muscles that originate on skull bones insert into our tongues. The attempts to account for the origin of that marvel resulted in myth. Blot any excess off with a towel. You should fall asleep more easily. While we sleep, our tongues loll around in our mouths, or anxiously probe about for evidence. When we walk down the street with our tongues, we may pucker up our lips to whistle. Others may simply talk to themselves. Others again put all of the mouth over the ball, sliding down until the lips touch the cone and then slowly withdraw it. An ellipse is a fairly advanced mathematical figure. We experience primitive emotions of awe and wonder. So we talk, running our tongues over the letters, like so many stops in a harmonica. And now it is time to examine the harmonica.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Tonight is a special tribute show for the late poet David Bromidge. You just heard him read a number of his poems over the years. I first met Petaluma poet Bill Vartna when I was having coffee with David Bromidge at Coffee Cats in Sebastopol. It was a Thursday afternoon, and apparently the two poets met together every Thursday around 1 o'clock. If you go to bromidge.wordpress.com, you'll see Bill Vartna's contribution to that site. I'm going to read an excerpt from it right now. It is Thursday as I write this. I cherished my Thursdays at one-ish with David. We would go to Coffee Cats, and I got to read his weekly installments of his memoirs, Till There Was You. He would read my prose and remark or play off of something I said. He finished his first draft, even getting to go to Africa at the end, which he never did. Well, I always wanted to. There is some poetic reality to that, he said, laughing. Later, I read to him from the Duncan Levertov correspondence. I didn't know Robert had been the one who had advised David to go to Berkeley when he received a scholarship in Vancouver, or that while at Berkeley, David had been Denise Levertov's teacher's assistant, as well as Tom Gunn's. David appears a few times in these letters. They both read and liked his books. At first, he was amazed at the clarity and intensity of their letters and how reminiscent it was of them for him. After a few pages, he said, "This is all well and good, but move ahead. I want to know what split them up." Unfortunately, his memoirs never went beyond the first draft stage. We worked on it a few times this spring when he was up to it. I was beginning to type out the handwritten pages and read them to him. He usually closed his eyes as I read, and his head would drop. Sometimes he fell asleep, but usually when I asked for a comment, I was surprised by his clarity. The last time was, I think, just 3 weeks ago. I was reading to David about his first day alone and out of England. He was in Copenhagen, taken by his guide to all the tourist spots. After I read him his chapter, he said he needed to say more about the Tivoli Gardens and asked if I would take dictation. This is what I took down from him. Tivoli Gardens is the name that formed my lasting impressions of Copenhagen. It was full of merriment with fanciful decorations, all manner of distraction and palm trees to gaze up into. Everyone seemed to be there to have a good time. Here were railroad tracks, vast vistas to enfold you, and surprises of every kind. And just imagine having such a playground to play in. And what was unusual about this park was the contained friendliness of its inhabitants. I can't speak for all times, but whenever I was there, the behavior of the natives was naturally cunning. It was as though everyone there apprehended his or her role as a performer, acted out this role to the full. The ducks, the drakes, the living specimens of the ages festooned their announcements with allure. Bands played in more than one hollow, and to be young there was to catch the excitement of every passing glance and form scenarios, shocking elsewhere, yet apparently attainable in the park's interior. That arm extended to you had no ulterior motive. It was an invitation to dance. And what could be more of a blessing than that? Partnership perched in the leaves that abounded the slopes where we dancers showed off. In 2006, David Bromidge and Richard Denner published a collaboration called Spade, and they came to my house to record from the book. That night, David wrote in the book, "For Catherine at home, feels good." Now, I didn't have a radio show at that time, and I also didn't have very good recording equipment, so I'm not going to play that recording. But fortunately, the two poets ventured on to Jack Foley's house in Oakland later, and they recorded from their book Spade there. So I'm going to play some excerpts from that recording now. Here are David Bromidge and Richard Denner reading from Spade.
Canto 14. And they will have place, and they will likewise really have place. A sense of place the Jesuits carried with them to Canada.
And the grinding and gnashing. No mistaking it.
A chance to be a pig. Chase a pig across the field. Smoking.
A man with a saucepan on his head. But it turned out he was pigging it out in a saucepan. I had an affinity with Richard Brautigan until he got famous. After he got famous, he got weird.
Trying to discover the proletariat.
I'd had enough of the proletariat in Canada. They wanted to look like bums, professors, sitting in coffee houses. How's the prostate?
It doesn't bother me.
More tests?
To see if I have prostate cancer.
The moment they opened their mouths and began to sing, I knew they were weed whackers.
And leaf blowers. Leaf blowers raise my ire. A noisy beauty for the eye. Nietzsche would have been was upset by a buggy whip. What would he do if a leaf blower interrupted a sentence?
Pound has to take some responsibility for two atom bombs and the Japanese brutality in Manchuria. Like the English, a certain illness from living on an island. Trace it back. Dying by atom bomb is the most interesting thing to happen in my lifetime.
Some still dying who were a long way away. 9-1-1, we took advantage, those planes being hijacked.
A wangle in foreign policy.
Dewey's vision. Educate everyone. Those were the ones that fought the Second World War. A smart lot could have created a paradise after the war.
Cheap goods and the expanded use of the internal combustion engine.
Broke the first seal.
One tends to be happy to go on living. There's so much jazz. And this room with us. And now.
If I was an angel, I'd run out of energy giving praise. It's just a fear I have. Fat chance I'd run out of energy.
Don't go there. It's a hill. Ask Sisyphus.
Chiron tried to get it together. Train a healer and a killer. Gave it up. Cashed in. Traded lots with Prometheus. Took his station on the beach.
Keep a smiley face on the whole show.
Things are just there. Nothing behind them. No cannibalism to solve the problem of immigration.
That sounds Lockean to me. I just mean, I don't know. I couldn't eat a cat. It wouldn't understand me eating it. I could eat a human being because he would understand. Well, I don't know. I don't know that he would understand. I'll have to think about that. But I don't... I don't know, that's how it goes. What I don't understand is the difference between murdering men and eating them. We murder people because we have such a negative feeling about them. And we can't eat them.
If we were coyotes, we would understand.
Why wouldn't that bastard eat a Jew in Prague? He's, say, had the Poles. The Poles can eat all the Jews and then be shot. The Poles, they wouldn't eat them, the Nazis. Too exclusionary to eat a Pole.
Everyone kept their eye on Queequeg. Everyone's quite trusting until you have a cannibal in your midst. Disrupts the nice veneer of civilization. Ishmael discovered cannibals to be superior beings with strong religious faith and accepted their head hunting.
Strange bedfellows. Well, homos are okay. I'll sleep with a homo if he sleeps on his side of the bed. But a cannibal, that's something else. And a queer cannibal, I wouldn't have dinner with a cannibal.
7 men on a yacht, 1 drink a day for 7 days off Nantucket.
At Luce's in Sebastopol, it's Donna, party of 4.
You're all invited to this party. I search for my inner idiot, but I keep my inner cannibal out of harm's way.
Kids sounded like chimps today.
Like a band of monkeys.
While still a child, I was subjected to bombing raids and rocket attacks by the Germans, and then, in 1945, to newsreels of the aftermath by my father of Belsen and other extermination camps, and those images invalidated any ability I had to imagine a human life perpetuating past its death. As more time passed, and it was realized that more than 50 million people had died in that war, I realized that the chance of my survival was chance indeed, and did not find in chance a ground for my immortal life. So I turned to writing, hoping that something I penned would open eyes to the truth of being human, and by these means extend my life through words. As time has gone by, I've come to realize the odds of being against this, but by now, it's an ingrained habit, this writing. I do it whether it's popular, as for a while in the 70s it was, and even today, when a recent book of mine won the Small Press Traffic Award. Frankly, I'm puzzled that my collaborator is not himself an atheist. I suspect that if you scratch a Buddhist, you'll find an atheist. How does he read this world so differently? What if his belief should deliver him into itself? To me, it's much too complicated. If anything's left over, it should be shared fairly among my wife and children. I hope a final illness that is that or this or two, so that I fall asleep and never have to wake up. I hope to leave enough money for a quiet funeral and to lie beneath a small tombstone that reads, "Life is brief," it says here. This is a sonnet written by my collaborator, Richard. It's Canto 44 from the Petrarch Project, our second book. The street is slippery and wet, and so east-west is refuge from the teeming rain. I have damp feet and, damn it, a cold brain. And there's a big protrusion in my shadow. Clarity and charity are fleeting. And no matter whatever I might wish, the air is belongs to invisible fish. Always warming, your welcome greeting, a special touch to what I need today. You prepare the perfect cup of chai. And while making change for me, you spy a tarnished coin and say softly, quickly, "Oh yes, it's worn, but it's not all that old." Suddenly, I'm all composed of gold. That's, of course, the East-West Cafe in Berkeley.
Sebastopol.
I mean, Sebastopol. I've lived here so long now, I think I'm living in Berkeley.
The last poem that we will hear David Bromidge read on tonight's show is a poem that appears in Spade, and he wrote it for his wife, Cecilia Bell.
Canto 54. My sorrow, Cecilia, and my love, have but a single source, as you, I trust, completely understand, that myself, now being old and ill, I'm altering beyond repair the man you fell for 30 years ago, Cecilia. 3 years I loved you, dear Cecilia, and never spoke of it. I saw your love was for your husband, and I liked the man and loved my wife, though not as I loved you. But then I heard you had split up. Ill will both ways, you wept. To understand, I asked for more, but we too understood. We parted with me saying, Cecilia, could we meet sometime? You took it ill, I thought, during your long pause. Love, the last thing on your mind. Then you, at last, spoke. Thanks. I needed that. Oh, man. I heard the thought built into that. A man could not help himself. She understands. As day by day I waited, days became weeks. You failed to phone. Ah, well, I see. Cecilia is not for me. A month had gone. David, love, a female student wants to speak to you. Ill, were you? I missed you. Silence. Then, ill mentally, I guess. I made a mistake. Wrong man. Wrong me. I kept wanting you. It's you I love. I can't tell you how glad I am to hear. I understand the delay. Glad to hear you're better, Cecilia. Can you see me at that cafe Tuesday noon? See you then. To my wife, an ex-student. Here, I'll show you some of her poetry. In the weeks that followed, the ill will between my wife and I ripened, while Cecilia and I were happy, as if for the first time, woman and man together, a joy that strengthened us until we understood the betrayal of our marriages must be borne for love. That without last betrayal. And it did. For love afresh came to our spouses. And for 26 years, you have come with me, through ill and good, to understand, as our wonderful, complex daughter shall, that of ill and good our lives are made, that often a man must wait out darkness, till soon or late, Cecilia, shine through. Hey, Cecilia, I hope, for any man patient and bold enough, though ill may be, but understanding, so that a you may come to you and learn your love.
Here now are David's wife, Cecilia, and daughter, Margaret.
I'm going to read a poem called Able to Describe the Verses, after Neruda, is the subtext there. David published it in Desire, and he did it by doing fake translations. Able to describe the verses. Able to describe the verses more sad each night. In the night, like the two of them between my arms, they kissed like tarantulas beneath an infinite sky. She quizzed me, I quizzed her back, as if I had a friend with big fizzy eyes. Able to think exactly as I said before, thinking that I can't go on, feeling lost. Ear to immensity's night, immense with her. On the other hand, my soul turns rocks into paste. What does it matter my love can't guard its shame? The night is starry, and she isn't with me still. So much for death, for song with its laws, for laws. My soul is not contented with having lost her someplace. As if she were here, I admire her hair suit, my heart her hair suit, and she isn't in it. The mismatched night blanks out the mismatched trees. Our sisters, those who entice the same backwards as forwards. I don't know why, that's certain, perhaps I should ask her. My voice grows furry as it blows about her idea. The other, be the other, come kiss me like before. Her voice, her clear form, her infinite pupils. Why is a night like the two of them between my arms? My discontented soul with the beauty it has lost. Why, I don't know for sure. Maybe we'll discuss some ways. The short tan of love, the large tan of oblivion. Although this sea is the ultimate sadness she can cause me, and, as I told Sean, this is the ultimate paper boat I shall make her. I had another poem I wanted to read from this book. The first poem in the book, and it is a poem that David was enjoying reading quite a bit in his last couple of years and read it at several readings. Revolving Door. Measured by ourselves alone, grief overwhelms. It cannot be contained without a larger scheme, as fortune's wheel. He left her in the hotel lobby, but can't leave her alone in his mind the light her apartment window is, as he staggers home elsewhere late at night. That they could make a kind of love only last night? This, our final kiss? Waiting, waiting for the airport bus, watched by two fat suits chuckling. Nice work, if you can get it. Christ, you'd swear, misery shown, but each must be alone. In his loss, he walks blindly into the revolving door, pushed as he pushes by a beauty, a call girl, maybe, or beloved hurrying to her lover, a beginning, or quite indifferent to his wounded maleness, his or anybody else's. The glass and wood wedge thrusts him into the street, on his shoulder, the weight and force of those imaginable thighs.
And then I have a poem I'm going to read called Abstract. Abstract. My desire precedes me. Who am its shadow for the light glows from beyond its further side? The flame to burn this shadow up when I am one with light. And so I live as darkness. And would this end be proof that flame, that flame flames that object? Interposes absolutely solid? I can't spare breath on happiness, nor any of its relatives' description. Of this kind must be distraction, for the god I am, the shadow of, once seared me in that flame and sealed my lips. I hurt to talk. My god must prove my spokesman. He adores the thing I am, the flame, the glowing happy flame, and sets an obstacle between.
Catherine, I think like a lot of people, we've been looking at David's books and enjoying his words again. And this was a poem I had forgotten all about and found just a few, well, about a month ago. And I think it's beautiful. Still there, the night mysterious with heat, its sky huge now with stars, the people sprawled in ragged groups, their voices quiet yet audible. What do they say? These constellations are indistinguishable from where we sit. A slight wind murmurs in the cypresses, set there to turn it back. The distances among the clusters are wild oat grass the sun's rays slowly leave. What do we know? It ceases. Others come to see as much as we. Those stars are me. These sounds, tears, blur and bring them to a field of points.
Hi, this is Margaret again. Here's a old song, a favorite of Dad and I's. It's called My Funny Valentine.
My funny Valentine, sweet comic Valentine, you make me smile with my heart. Your looks are laughable, unphotographable, yet you're my favorite work of art. Is your figure less than Greek? Is your mouth a little weak? When you open it to speak, are you smart? But don't change a hair for me, not if you care for me. Stay, little Valentine, stay. Each day is Valentine's Day.
And that concludes this special tribute to David Bromidge. In the background, you'll hear the Drifters singing Under the Boardwalk, a song David Bromidge requested be played at his memorial service. My many thanks go out to everyone who had a part in this tribute, especially Cecilia and Margaret.
And your shoes get so hot, you wish your tired feet were fireproof. Under the boardwalk, down by the sea, yeah. On a blanket with my babies, where I'll be. Under the boardwalk,
out of the sun.
Under the boardwalk,
having some fun.
Under the boardwalk,
people walking about.
Under the boardwalk,
we'll be falling in love.
Under the boardwalk,
boardwalk.
In the park you hear the happy sound of the carousel. You can almost taste the hot dogs, French fries they sell. Under the down by the sea, yeah. On a blanket with my babies, where I'll be.
Under the boardwalk,
out of the sun.
Under the boardwalk,
we'll be having some fun.
Under the boardwalk,
people walking about.
Under the boardwalk,
we'll be falling in love.
Under the boardwalk,
boardwalk.